From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Over the months, the drumbeat got louder on the campaign trail as reporters and candidates pressed Senator Elizabeth Warren to get specific on her health care plan. Medicare for all, she promised, but no details on how it would work or how the U.S. would pay for it. Well, last week, the senator unveiled a highly detailed plan. It's won some praise from progressives for making Wall Street, drug companies, and the richest Americans carry more of the load. But Senator Warren is taking a lot of flack, too, and from her fellow Democrats. So this hour on Point, Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan. Would it work? What would it cost? And would any Medicare for All plan survive past the campaign stage and in Congress? You can join us. Senator Warren says the issue isn't if the U.S. can pay, but who pays for health care. Does that ring true to you? Or do you have a hard time believing Senator Warren when she says Medicare for All won't cost the average taxpayer more than they're already paying? Join us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And I just want to make something clear from the start here. We reached out multiple times to Senator Warren's campaign to see if someone directly associated with the campaign, or definitely the senator herself, if they could join us. We never heard back from the Warren campaign. So let's start first in New York. Jonathan Cohn joins us. He's a senior national correspondent covering healthcare for HuffPost. And we've got links to his stories on Senator Warren's healthcare plan at onpointradio.org. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here.
Okay, so first of all, let's listen to a little bit of what Senator Warren did say on the campaign trail. Here she is in Des Moines, Iowa, on Friday, talking about her plan on how to pay for Medicare for All.
We can have Medicare for All without raising taxes 1 cent on middle-class families. And it's all fully paid for by asking the top 1% and giant corporations to pay a fair share.
That's Senator Warren in Iowa on Friday. So, Jonathan Cohn, that first claim that she makes that her plan would not raise taxes 1 cent on the middle class, fact check that for us.
Well, you know, it's one of those questions, that statements that really depends on how you interpret it. You know, on paper, she's right. I mean, she has constructed a plan that does not impose a new tax that falls directly on the middle class, and she has, insofar as she's sort of looking for new taxes to help finance this, she has really put them exclusively on the wealthy and on corporations. You know, that's a big part of her financing. You know, the asterisk there, there's actually several asterisks there, but I would say, you know, one of the most important is that she does ask employers to contribute towards the cost of insurance. Whether that's, you know, that's not really a new, the way she's structured it, she's basically said to employers, I want you to keep paying what you're paying now. So that's not really a new tax. On the other hand, if you talk to most economists, they would say that, well, you know, when employers pay for insurance, even if it's out of their own pockets, eventually that's coming out of wages, and you kind of grow down the line. And in the grand scheme of things, some people would say, well, that's actually still a tax on healthcare. It's just it's on the employers, which eventually passes to the employees. You know, I would say that's a, you know, you could say it's a true, I would say it's a true statement, but, you know, it's true with a lot of caveats that you need to understand.
Right. So I just want to kind of get a big picture view of things here, because in the past couple of days, you know, on TV and on the radio, we've been hearing all sorts of numbers, 20 trillion, 52 trillion over 10 years. I mean, they all have a certain shock value here. But factually, Senator Warren is claiming that overall, the United States, even if it makes no changes to its healthcare system, is going to spend more than $50 trillion in the next 10 years. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. And that is true as well.
That is a true fact. I mean, it's a true projection. I mean, who knows what we'll be doing in 10 years? Maybe an asteroid will hit or whatever. But yeah, that is what the best guess we have is. Yes.
Barring an asteroid, we're going to be paying more than $50 trillion in 10 years. So that's already
right.
happening. And she claims that her plan would cost the same, if not less than that. So the overall spending isn't changed, possibly reduced. Now, how does she get that reduction in?
Right. So this is a really important part of the discussion. When we talk about what the plan is going to cost, you know, what is it going to cost to give everybody health insurance through this new Medicare for All system? And you know, we have sort of forces that are going to kind of push in two directions, right? So on the one hand, you know, when you go to a single payer system, the government's more efficient than having all these private insurers. Hospitals don't have to spend all that money on billing, so that saves money. In addition, when the government is running the whole insurance program, it can sort of, you know, it can set an overall budget and it can sort of dictate to hospitals and doctors, you know, what they're going to get paid. It can negotiate directly with drug makers, and that can save money. On the other hand, you're giving a lot of people insurance who don't have it already. And remember, the insurance for people who already have coverage, you have, let's say, you know, through an employer, your insurance is about to get better. Your deductibles are going to go away. Your out-of-pocket costs are going to go away. You know, that's really one of the main goals of Medicare for All. But, of course, when you give people better insurance or you give people insurance they didn't have, they consume a lot more health care. And so that's going to drive costs up. So when we sit and decide, well, how much is Medicare for All going to cost, you have to take into account both, well, what's the sort of, you know, what's pushing the cost up, all these new people getting health care, what's pushing the cost down, the savings, the administration savings, the dictating cost to hospitals and doctors. And it basically, the cost comes out to where you, how you assume that's all going to net out. She has kind of come up with numbers that she says, look, I kind of put that all together and we stay at right at the same level we are today. Some people would say, you know, is that right? Is that wrong? That's the debate we're having.
Right. So again, that's the, she keeps asking, the question is, who's going to pay for it, right? And so essentially what we have here is a proposal that calls for roughly $20 trillion of new federal spending. But she says that federal spending would come from, like you said, employers paying a Medicare for All tax, a higher tax on the wealthiest Americans, things like that. Now, she's been already getting quite a bit of pushback from her fellow Democrats on the campaign trail. Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, Joe Biden, who all you know, advocate a more incremental approach here. So I just want to, last question for you, Jonathan, but let me set it up by playing this moment from former Vice President Joe Biden on PBS NewsHour on Friday. He says that Warren's claim that her plan would cost $20 trillion is unrealistic.
He's making it up. Look. Nobody thinks it's $20 trillion. It's between $30 and $40 trillion. Every major independent study that's gone out there that's taken a look at this, there is no way, even Bernie, who talks about the need to raise middle class taxes, he can't even meet the cost of it. Look, we don't have to go that route.
So, Jonathan, my last question for you is, tell us about the kind of pushback she's getting about the veracity of the very numbers she's using.
Sure. So what we were talking about a minute ago, we were saying, how much is this really going to cost? And you know, we said, well, it sort of depends on how much money do you think you can save by simplifying billing and making the system easier for people to use? And how much can you really drive down doctor prices and hospital prices, and how much savings can you get from prescription drugs? She's got a very optimistic set of figures on that. Now, they're not crazy. I mean, she's got very smart people vouching for them and saying, yes, we can get this amount of savings. But what Joe Biden was saying there is also true, which is that a lot of other experts who have looked at this have said, there's just no way to get that much savings realistically. You can't get doctor prices down that much. You can't get hospital prices down that much. And this is partly a judgment about politics. You know, hospitals have really powerful lobbying groups. The drug industry is super powerful. They're going to fight these things. And some of this is the fact that when you really get into the nitty-gritty of sort of trying to, like, you know, extract waste from the system, a lot of times it turns out to be a lot harder in practice than it is in theory. So, you know, I would say the argument that Joe Biden was making there that, you know, most experts are skeptical of this. There's certainly a lot of experts who are skeptical. They have good reason to be skeptical of it. You know, if Warren, you know, would say, well, look, I have experts who think it's possible. We know we spend way more than other countries. There's waste there. You know, that's true also. So, I mean, this is a tough argument.
Well, we're actually going to hear from one of those very experts in just a moment. So Jonathan Cohn, senior national correspondent covering healthcare for HuffPost. Thanks so much for being with us, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, joining us now in the On Point studio is Simon Johnson. He's professor of entrepreneurship at the MIT Sloan School of Management, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He co-authored two expert letters for the Warren campaign analyzing the costs and revenue projections of Senator Warren's Medicare for All plan. He was not paid for his contribution, but he did co-author those two expert letters. Simon Johnson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you heard what Jonathan Cohn said about sort of the political realities that would need to be met in order to achieve the cost reductions that Senator Warren presumes she can get in American healthcare. It does seem rather ambitious, and I don't think, you know, if the past is any indication of the future, that the healthcare system won't be able to achieve some $14 trillion in cost reductions to make the senator's plan a reality.
Here's the big picture, Meghna. We have a health cost crisis in this country. It's not a new crisis, a long-standing crisis. We spend 18% of GDP, 18% of the entire economy spent on healthcare. No other industrial country spends more than 13%. Some spend 8% for the same outcomes that we get. Maybe we can afford 18%, which is where we are now. Well, fine. But can we afford 21%, which is what the forecast says is going to be 2027? Can we afford 35%, 40%? Because this is where it's going. This is a train wreck, and you need to have a comprehensive approach in order to bring the cost down. Now, all the points Jonathan made are very good points about cost control within the existing system or within the Joe Biden proposal or the Pete Buttigieg proposal. They're going to struggle. You need a single payer. That's the only way costs have been brought under control anywhere in the world at this macroeconomic level.
I know that the senator has gone out of her way in recent debates to not say that taxes on the middle class would be raised. And Bernie Sanders stood right next to her and said, that is not true. You will have to do that. We've got just 30 seconds to go before the break, but I'll allow you to start making your case. How can the senator, why are there two such differing visions of who's going to have to pay here?
I don't know what Bernie is talking about. He doesn't have a plan. If he wants me to evaluate it, I'm happy to come and do that for him. In Elizabeth Warren's plan, taxes, payments by the middle class go down. $11 trillion effective tax cut over the next 10 years, Meghna. Let's talk about that.
Okay, well, we'll do that when we come back. So Simon Johnson, stand by here for just a moment. We are talking about the nitty-gritty details of Senator Elizabeth Warren's Medicare for All plan, and specifically, I mean, this is a detailed proposal on how we would pay for it. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the details inside Senator Warren's Medicare for All plan. She released this plan last week, and it's an extensive explanation on how she would pay for Medicare for All, or how a potential Warren administration would pay for it. I'm joined in the On Point studio today by Simon Johnson. He's a professor of entrepreneurship at the MIT Sloan School of Management, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, co-authored a couple of expert letters for the Warren campaign, analyzing the costs of her plan. In a few minutes, we'll hear from another expert economist with a differing view about the potential to pay for Medicare for All. But Professor Johnson, so I do, like you said before the break, I do want to take this down to the level of sort of clear factual simplicity for people to understand, because healthcare is a hot mess of numbers. Just tell me, in your most direct terms, for the average person, what would they be paying under a Warren plan?
Nothing. So this is the key. This is the key.
How
point.
Is that possible?
So let me explain. So right now, Meghna, in the forecast, the best forecast that we have, which are not our forecasts, they're official government forecasts, American families, so households, will pay over the next 10 years a combined $11 trillion in insurance, premiums, copays, deductibles, and other out-of-pocket expenses. That's an enormous amount of money. Under the Warren plan, that goes to zero. absolutely to zero. You don't pay anything. So where does the extra funding come from to cover that $11 trillion? That's what comes from the taxes on the wealthiest individuals, the largest corporations. They go after tax avoidance, global tax avoidance, which is a huge number. And all they do, Meghna, is move our tax rates on those large companies and on in terms of collecting from these people to the OECD average. Because we're so bad at this right now. Rich people are not like you and me, Meghna. They don't pay tax.
But isn't that a pretty big assumption right there, that we would get really good very quickly at repatriating money from the richest Americans?
There's already a process at the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which is pursuing this. It's going at a glacial pace. Somebody needs to light a fire under them. But there is no other major trading country that we have that likes tax havens and this massive tax avoidance. All countries are fed up with it because they all face fiscal pressure. So we're pushing on an open door there.
Okay. So you went through the three things that Americans typically end up paying for: premiums, prescription drug costs, and out-of-pocket expenses. Okay, I understand the premiums part, because if all of that is flowing through the federal government, that goes down to zero. Prescription drugs, we can talk about in a minute. But the out-of-pocket portion, how can you guarantee that would go to zero? Does that not presume that people would be able to get the same standard of care, the same type of care, the same services under a Medicare for All system that they are currently sometimes paying a lot of out-of-pocket expenses for?
The proposal is to expand Medicare, and actually there are some gaps in the Medicare coverage, as you likely know, and to close those gaps. So it is Medicare coverage, single payer by the government, but you have complete choice over providers. The provider, doctor, hospital system remains completely private under this Warren proposal. So all that's happening is we're going from these multiple incredibly inefficient and expensive private insurance arrangements with massive, massive waste, Meghna, in the non-elderly care in this country. Okay, they take the waste out with the single payer. You can cover everybody. And you can also transfer what's currently being borne by families onto very, very wealthy people, this top 1%, and the large corporations that are currently dodging taxes on a colossal global scale.
So about large corporations here, I mean, the plan says that it wouldn't just be large corporations. For, any company that employs more than 50 people that's currently paying healthcare premiums for their employees would still continue to pay this Medicare for All tax, essentially.
Okay,
so it's not just large corporations.
This is a key point, Meghna, and I think Jonathan at the beginning was really good, but I disagree with one word phrasing that he used, and it's quite important, which is right now, under the Affordable Care Act, all employers with more than 50 employees are required by law to either buy health insurance for their employees or to pay a fine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a tax. I'm sorry. It's a government regulation that requires you to make a payment. Now, in this case, it's to a private set of bodies, insurance companies that are incredibly inefficient and waste massive amounts of money and don't get good prices for you, but that's a tax. So right now, the employees are paying a tax. Under the one proposal, they pay less. They pay this contribution is 98% of what they pay, no more than 98% of what they pay now. If they're paying zero, they pay zero. So that's a reduction, no matter what you want to call it, a tax or a duck or anything, that's a reduction in what the employees are paying right now.
Because she's capping it at 98%.
Right.
Okay. Well, I have so many follow-ups for you, Professor Johnson, but I am going to bring in another voice into the conversation here first. Mark Pauly joins us now from Philadelphia. He's a professor of healthcare management, business economics, and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, former commissioner on the Physician Payment Review Commission, which offers advice to Congress on healthcare reform, and he's been a consultant to the Congressional Budget Office as well. Professor Pauly, welcome to you.
Hello.
Do you think Senator Warren's plan, the math in the plan, checks out?
Well, any projection is by economists is all fuzzy math. As Yogi Berra might have said, fuzzy math projections are fuzzy math, especially about the future. And so is this one. There is a set of assumptions cleverly. I have to give credit for the team that put together these set of numbers to make the target hit the bullet have no explicit tax on the middle class. They did a wonderful job with a kind of tight squeeze. But as the saying goes, there's no guarantees. And really, I think what people ought to think about is what assumptions do you need to make in order for these guesses to be true? What bets would you be making if you decided that the numbers could be correct? That's important to say.
So then,
but what bets would you be making that would have to be true to have that happen?
So I guess what you're saying is you think that some of the assumptions are erroneous? Which one? What do you think are they? What are they assuming that you don't think is right?
I don't know. They're erroneous. They're just wild leaps of faith.
Oh, so too optimistic then?
Yes.
And so then, what do you actually? What would you project in the future? Then, what would be the set of assumptions that you would say we ought to actually be using?
Well, it all turns on politics, on which I'm not an expert, but then who is? If President Warren were able to get into office and also sweep both houses of Congress with a veto-proof majority and followed the strategy of the current president to actually doing everything she promised to her base, regardless of whatever obstacles might be put in the way, the fundamental element of this plan, which is the government will set prices ultimately to be paid to doctors and hospitals and drug companies. Well, you can set those – if you have control of setting those prices, you can make spending be whatever you want it to be. The question is whether you can do so without doing more harm than good, but you certainly can make spending be whatever you say it's going to be. You can basically tell hospitals, who are the biggest spenders, here's how much money we're going to give you next year. Do the best you can, and we'll see what they do.
So if I may, Professor Pauly, I mean, I think what I heard you just say is that short of any party having control of the White House and both branches of Congress and basically total and complete power over the federal government to institute whatever policies it wants, short of that, you can't really do much at all. I mean, we're never going to have a political infrastructure in Washington that is like that. There's always going to be messy politics here. So why let perfection be the enemy of the good, as they say, or even the enemy of the bold?
Well, yes, until the angels come down to earth to run the government, that's probably true. But I'll put my cards on the table. My personal preference is to improve Obamacare. It has some need for improvement, most of which seem to me to be at least potentially politically feasible if the people in Washington would stop fighting and start working.
Yeah. Well, Professor Johnson, I'm sure you have a response for Professor Pauly here.
Well, look, Professor Pauly, Mark is entirely correct that under a single-payer system, you can control costs. That's the main point here. And that's what the experience from around the world. I was formerly the chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. People sometimes joke it's called It's Mostly Fiscal. So I've worked for more than 30 years around the world on budgets and various aspects of this. The lesson is if you want to control your costs, if you want to prevent healthcare from eating the economy, you're going to end up eventually with some sort of single payer system. Now, do you want to do it now at 18% of GDP, which is a manageable number, arguably? Are you going to wait till 25%? Are you going to wait till 35%? I think that's the choice that's before us right now. And as for the politics, I think I would focus on this, Meghna, which is the $11 trillion tax cut here. Households will pay $11 trillion less over the next 10 years. That's bigger than any tax cut that any Republican ever managed to put through. Ronald Reagan's tax cut was no more than 3% of GDP. This is the biggest middle-class tax cut ever prepared in the context of a redistribution, taxes onto the wealthy and the non-paying right now large corporations, in order to support and finance Medicare being available for everyone. People like Medicare. Medicare is a very good program. By the way, lots of political people said Medicare could never happen. There was a ton of opposition to that, and it happened.
So, but let me ask you, because you keep saying single payer here. I mean, can we really look at all the healthcare systems in other industrialized nations that have universal coverage? Can we call them all single payer, though?
Single payer means that you have one insurance, one social insurance company or fund or government-run entity, right? So that's one important concept here. Another important concept is universal coverage. And it is true that most of our competitor nations have universal, near-universal coverage, and they have a single-payer system. What they differ on is who runs the providers. So in Britain, where I was born, the hospitals and many of the doctors work for the government through the National Health Service. That's not on the table here. It's private providers in the United States currently. It'll be private providers in the United States going forward. The only difference is we're replacing this incredibly inefficient and frankly wasteful private insurance structure with all the billing and all the costs involved in that, which are enormous for everybody throughout the system. We're replacing that with a single payer. That's what's on the table.
I'm going to come back to that here. But Professor Pauly, do you have a response for Simon Johnson?
Well, I think it's important to know how other countries do it. And the answer was provided by my good friend Uwe Reinhardt, who just passed away, the world's funniest health economist, who said, it's the price is stupid.
Right.
So other countries pay lower prices to not just for drugs, but for hospitals and doctors. And Uwe, I hope, would have said, and for hospitals and doctors, it's the wages stupid. So doctors make more in the United States than they do in other countries by a substantial margin. So do nurses. So by a less substantial margin, but still a margin, all the people who work in hospitals and elsewhere in healthcare, we could have costs or spending, not costs. We could have spending like other countries do if we would pay the people who work in healthcare less well. Now, you, Simon, may be in favor of that, of taking money out of, course, probably we wouldn't mind taking it away from orthopedic surgeons, but I don't know about phlebotomists or other people who work in healthcare. So that's really the choice we face there. If we want to follow other countries, do we want to move toward a system in which people are less well paid for working to improve the health of the population than what we do in the United States? And at least as an economist, you know, I don't have a preference in that regard. I married a doctor's daughter, so I guess I have some pressure at home for one direction rather than another. But from the point of view of economic welfare, that's just a transfer from people who buy health care to people who make health care. And maybe we should make less of a transfer than we're currently making now. Maybe not. It's who you like.
Okay. So I hear the medical lobby saying, we don't want to get paid less, Simon Johnson. But I'm not. All joking aside, I'm looking at the Warren proposal right here, and it says they've even bolded it that Medicare for All will sharply reduce administrative spending, which we've talked about, and reimburse physicians and other non-hospital providers at current Medicare rates. Now, I do know thousands of doctors who say that is the problem because the rates aren't, Medicare rates are not high enough. So Mark Pauly's actually, they would say he's making a good point. You're controlling costs by cutting wages.
All right. There are 28 pages in the report, Meghna. And when we're in a break, we'll find the next page, which talks about the reduction in inefficiency. So the key thing, so doctors by the, you know, studies indicate doctors spend an hour a day talking to insurance companies. Each doctor has nurses spend about 20-plus hours a week dealing with insurance companies. This is about 10% of their costs. It's at least 10% of their costs for hospitals. So we have 28 pages. Don Berwick, who's a leading expert on these granular details, and I.
Precisely, I'm looking at it. $210 billion average spent annually on these costs.
And it goes on. We have pages and pages, Meghna, where we go through this. So the proposal is not, on average, to cut the compensation of the healthcare workers. Now, there may be some people who would do better and some people who would do less well under this. Okay, fine. That's the case anytime you change any policy. But this is not about reducing compensation on average or total in the healthcare system. In fact, the demand for healthcare workers is going to be stronger. A lot of hospital, the average utilization of hospital capacity in the country right now is about 65%. That's going to go up. We have spare capacity. That's part of the point here. People are going to be working. There's going to be lots of good jobs in this sector. The jobs are going to be well paid, but the billing, the insurance, all of that hassle goes away. The non-elderly care in this country, Meghna, is the most inefficient by a long margin compared with any country that's at all comparable to us.
I mean, the argument is that there's an industry built around that inefficiency.
Yes, it's called tax farming, actually. That's the technical historical nature for it, which is you lobby the government, you get the right to collect a tax. Right, the government makes people pay. You pay the government a fixed fee. Let's call that campaign donations and lobbying costs. And then the industry gets to keep it, and they get to keep the upside, and they get to stuff their pockets with massive compensation. That's tax farming. That's a medieval structure, actually, Meghna, which this country didn't have much of, turns out, at the beginning of the Republic. Now we've got a lot more of it. Special interests have a grip on this, and they're choking the economy. These costs are being borne by families. Families are going bankrupt. Families can't pay these bills. It's tragic. And the company's competitiveness and our ability to compete in the global economy is undermined not by taxes, not by regulation, but by healthcare costs.
Look, nobody loves the fact that we're edging towards 20% of GDP being spent on healthcare. But the question is this the best way to get a hold of that? We have a minute and a half to go before a break, but I'm going to make my staff completely furious. I'm going to go to a caller here. Let's go to Sean, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Go ahead, Sean.
Hi. I can only look at my paycheck and I pay my health premium weekly. I pay $155. My employer pays $55, and my federal tax is $37. So even if my federal taxes went way up, I would still be paying less money. That's my point. Thank you.
For it. Thank you so much, Sean. Mark Pauly, we just got half a minute to go before a break. Respond to what Sean says. He sees this as a very measurable gain for him. Plus, he gets health care.
Yeah, well, it is, although, of course, the savings on the employee portion of the premium will be offset in part by higher taxes that you'll have to pay when what's currently a non-taxable benefit becomes taxable. But you will pay more taxes. That's my nitpicking with the senator's comment that not a penny more. I pay $4,000 a year explicitly for my health insurance. I'll have to pay tax on that, and I'm lucky enough to be well off to pay a high marginal tax rate, so it's going to cost me $2,000, but I will net $2,000 out of it. So in that sense, it's true. And most of the game here is to find other ways of raising the money that replaces what the employee's contribution would have been.
Uh-huh. Well, Mark Pauly and Simon Johnson, hang on here for just a second. We are having a vigorous debate about the math and the realities behind Senator Warren's detailed plan on how she would pay for Medicare for All. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We are diving into the details and debating the details this hour of Senator Warren's proposal on how she would pay for Medicare for All. And I'm joined today by Simon Johnson. He's a professor of entrepreneurship at the MIT Sloan School of Management, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund. And he co-authored two expert letters for the Warren campaign, analyzing the costs and revenue projections in her plan. Mark Pauly joins us from Philadelphia. He's a professor of healthcare management and business economics and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. And just as a reminder to everyone, we did indeed reach out to the Warren campaign to invite the senator or any member of her direct campaign staff to join us. We did not hear back. Now, Simon Johnson, you wanted to respond to our caller, Sean, who, just to remind folks, said that his federal tax roughly monthly was $37, but he pays $200 in healthcare premiums.
$155 is what he
said. $155. And so even if you increased his tax, he would still come out ahead if he didn't have to pay directly for his healthcare.
Yes, this is a very instructive example. His employer pays $55 per pay period. He pays $155 per pay period. He said he spends $37 federal tax. Now, of course, I don't know all his circumstances, including his family and so on, but I would estimate that he'll get the $155, which is right now withheld from his paycheck. That's his money, by the way. That's his wage. It just gets deducted at source. He never touches it. That comes into his paycheck, and Mark is right. It goes into his taxable income. I reckon he'll pay about an extra $2 in additional tax. So he's going to get $155 minus two, let's call that $153 additional income to spend. And he's not going to spend any money at all on healthcare. There's no out-of-pockets. There's no deductibles, anything like that. So this is $153 after taxes and after healthcare insurance. Now, also, Mark said that he reckons he would save his healthcare premiums about $4,000 on this pre-tax basis. He's going to pay a higher marginal tax rate. So he, Mark, will only be net $2,000, half of that. I'm afraid, Mark, that's how a progressive tax system works. That's why the income tax system is actually rather good compared to other tax systems. People at the low end pay a very low average tax. People at the higher end pay a much higher marginal tax. That is the way the system works. Everybody's going to gain. Mark is net $2,000, which is a significant amount of money. I don't know what his income is. Sean sounded like he totally got the message, which is he's net plus $153 per pay period. That's a big bump up for Sean.
Okay, so Mark Pauly, Simon Johnson, they're saying we've inadvertently proven Senator Warren's point that most if not all middle class Americans would come out ahead and the rich would have to pay more.
Well, I guess it's most, if not all. I am a magnanimous person. I wish I paid a higher marginal tax rate than I do now. But from a purely self-interested point of view, the big cost to me from this plan arises because University of Pennsylvania, not exactly a giant corporation, although a giant source of employment, pays about 80% of my health care costs. I pay about 20%. Workers in general here pay about 20%. That's above the average. And so that means that those of us who work for firms that make larger contributions toward a given amount will get less back because we make smaller contributions ourselves. And not only that, because we sacrificed money wages in order to be able to pay smaller contributions, we're going to be stuck with our same lower money wages that we started with. So we get a double whammy. We don't get back as much as people who formerly worked for companies that were less generous. And we have lower wages than people who work for companies that were formerly less generous. And that's because the tax that we bear that's run through our employer, the employer's contribution, is larger for us. So it's unfair. Mm-hmm. So I guess economists are supposed to talk about efficiency, not equity, but this seems to me, maybe from a pure self-interested point of view, to be pretty unfair. Maybe it'll weather the political storm because the people who work for firms that were more generous are actually going to lose relative to the people who work for firms that were less generous. Talk about rewarding virtue. Uh-huh. This is the opposite of it.
Well, Simon Johnson, I'll allow you to respond to Professor Pauly, but I also want to make room for some callers. But go ahead.
Yeah, so for 2 points, Meghna. One is that employers are going to pay initially almost exactly what they're paying now, a little bit of reduction. So Sean's employer pays $55. He said that's his contribution. I think that straightforward math is going to be about $54. So no shock there, no increase in the cost of employing Sean, right? No impact on Sean's job from this. That's very important. Secondly, to Mark's point, he is right that initially your contribution is 98%, the employer contribution is 98% of what they were paying previously. But it says very clearly on pages 4 and 5 of our expert letter, we looked at this in believe me, minute detail because it matters a lot, that the contribution converges to the average contribution. So there's a phase in, and it's a good question, would that be 4 years or 5 years or 6 years? There's a phase in that addresses exactly the point that Mark is making. So you don't want to shock the system, Meghna. Mm-hmm. You don't want to bump up anyone's cost of employing anyone. That's really, really important, okay? Super important to be responsible on that. Mark has got a good point, though, that there are differential payments made by different employers per employee, and we should recognize that. And over time, those will converge so that all employers per employee are making the same contribution to this employer Medicare contribution.
Okay, let's go to our callers. Let's go to Peter, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, it's a great thing, Elizabeth Warren is saying, but why are you people fighting it? It's unbelievable that we become a cruel and inhumane nation that makes people go bankrupt for getting sick. And people are arguing against this because it seems the only people this is going to hurt are people that have to pay a little more taxes who can already afford the best insurance they can possibly afford. Mm. And so whatever the taxes they're going to be paying higher is not going to hurt them at all. The only thing that hurts is average Americans. And anybody who fights against this is completely retarded. I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Peter, thank you for your call. Professor Pauly, would you like to respond to Peter's basically saying there's a moral argument here that we cannot ignore.
Well, certainly there's a moral argument that everyone should have adequate insurance coverage, which I would define as coverage which allowed them to consume cost-effective amounts of all kinds of care. But that's certainly something that can be done. The question is whether this is the best way to get there. And the alternative, as I've already suggested, is to start with Obamacare and fix the gaps. We're down to about 8% of people without insurance. I'm not sure who the caller is thinking of people who are going bankrupt. There's still enough, fortunately, for journalists to write articles about it, but it must be a small fraction of the population. But I don't think we should be satisfied with that. We could, without much effort, I know you don't want to talk about alternatives here, but without much effort, you could get that percentage uninsured down to the same level as in other developed countries. It's possible to go bankrupt in Germany also from healthcare costs. Having lived there, I can tell you, fortunately, I didn't go bankrupt, but it was a possibility. But So there are other ways of doing it, and I believe better ways than totally upending the current system in order to achieve what is actually going to be a relatively small gain in terms of what I think is the most important thing, which is making sure people have decent health insurance coverage that allows them to afford cost-effective amounts of care. Mm-hmm. Putting a lid on health care spending growth, well, that I think is much more debatable, whether that whether there's a way to do that in ways that will do more good than harm. But candidates, of course, should knock themselves out trying to figure out how to do it. Right. Nobody else has figured out how to do it yet, but maybe they can.
Well, I just want to play the voice of another candidate who had a strong response to Senator Warren's plan. Here is South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg on ABC's This Week last Sunday.
What is just not true is that HERS is the only solution. This my way or the highway idea that either you're for kicking everybody off their private plans in 4 years or you're for business as usual, it's just not true. I'm proposing Medicare for all who want it. Now, if we do that, that's the biggest change in American healthcare in 50 years. The difference is the way I would do it, you get to keep your private plan if you want to.
Simon Johnson, what do you think?
Look, there are many ways to reform the healthcare system without question. But if you want to control the costs, and if you want to ensure the middle class doesn't pay more, in fact, Senator Warren's proposing they pay significantly less, you've got to tackle the entirety of the inefficiency. That's where the savings are, Meghna. If you just add on a bit here, a bit there, and so on and so forth, you're bumping up the cost of the system. Now, I think Mark and Pete Buttigieg have absolutely got admirable intentions, and I'm not speaking to that whatsoever. I think we're all on the same page with regard to moral coverage. But let me ask you this. Members of Congress have a good health insurance. Why can't we all have the same kind of health insurance that they do? And the answer is, Meghna, we can. And I think the pressure and the burden should be on people who say, who want to explain to you why you can't have the same, we all can't have the same health insurance as our legislative representatives. And I think every member of Congress should answer that question too.
So let's get back to this issue of the cost, controlling cost here. And I'm not sure if this is the perfect analogy. It's not, but it's a useful one. I mean, Professor Johnson, you and I are sitting right here in Boston, Massachusetts. And I want to use the Massachusetts example here what does it illustrate? Because, you know, we're more than 10 years out now from having near universal coverage. Health insurance coverage in Massachusetts, okay? And we have, it's not single payer by any means, but there are only a small number of insurers in this state. But the costs, healthcare costs in Massachusetts have not been brought under control by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, the Warren plan talks about that, you know, that Medicare for All would break up hospital monopolies. It would increase competition in healthcare. I mean, in Massachusetts, we've seen the progressive growing of major medical monopolies in this state, or maybe I can't call them monopolies, but really, really big hospital groups getting even bigger. I'm just wondering, like, what does this example show us of the limits of what Senator Warren is imagining nationally?
No, it shows you the limits of limited or even state-specific reform, Meghna. As you yourself said, you don't have a single-payer system here. You don't have a large Medicare system of the type that Senator Warren is envisioning that can bargain. The bargaining power that you have, for example, against predatory drug prices, you only get that, seriously, if you've got big national players and you can sit down with them. That's what other countries do. That's what we need to do. We're giving money to drug companies that are, frankly, honestly, ripping us off. Okay, that's the reality here. Not all drug companies, and I'm in favor of innovation. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship at MIT. We have a lot of biotech around there, and there's language about supporting innovation and what that would mean absolutely in their plan and in our letter. But you can't do this piecemeal, Meghna. That's the point. That's the problem. You can do things piecemeal, and you can make yourself feel good about it, and maybe you waste 3 years struggling to get it through Congress, and at the end of the day, your cost to GDP go up to 22%, and then you find, oh my goodness, we still have some uninsured people because we couldn't quite make ends meet. That is completely unnecessary, Senator. Warren's plan is the most detailed, most comprehensive attempt to cut through all of that and say, look, we can do better and all middle class people will spend less by $11 trillion over 10 years. It's the biggest middle class tax cut ever, Meghna. It's not the question of is it an increase of this or that. No, that's irrelevant. That's wrong. It's a tax cut of $11 trillion, just like Sean from Iowa said.
Mark Pauly, go ahead.
Well, I've got a bridge to sell you, but is one reaction. But I do think this unlimited fund of inefficiency, which Simon wants to draw on to pay for all of these wonderful improvements, is largely a myth. At least it's not something we have evidence that anybody knows how to tap it. In particular, of course, I would certainly not claim healthcare is efficient. Think of the industry in which he and I both work, academics. It's not efficient. We have rising administrative costs here. The faculty, of course, are all angry about that because if it weren't for them, we could get bigger raises or smaller teaching schedules, perhaps. But whatever it is, there's inefficiency, and there's some inefficiency in healthcare. I attribute the worst of it to the tax break that I mentioned earlier that I get, which caused me to choose the most lavish plan here at Penn, which causes me to spend more than I otherwise would. Why am I getting an $8,000 tax cut to buy health insurance, which I assume would continue under the Warren plan, when I really don't need it? But the fundamental point is that even administrative costs, well, why are they there? They're there in large part because we have multiple health plans. So do they in continental Europe. I don't think it's true that all developed countries have single payer. That's just wrong. But we have more choice among different plans. And frankly, when I talk to people, they like having choice. You can give up choice and save a lot of administrative cost. You could save the cost of men's sport coats if everybody wore a size 44 regular, but they wouldn't fit. So that's the dilemma, I think. To some extent, the administrative costs are there because of this tax break, so I don't mind paying
but
them.
Mark,
but to another extent, it's the cost of choice.
Let me just jump in here for one second. I want to provide some like concrete numbers around what you're saying. Look, the Warren campaign says that private insurers have administrative costs that are 12% of the premiums they collect, but Medicare's administrative costs are 2.3%. So six times less.
Yeah, well, so
certainly there's room to wring some efficiencies out of that.
Not certainly. It depends on how you do it. Large employer-based plans have administrative costs of about 4 or 5% and within hailing distance of Medicare, which omits some costs, like the cost of paying members of Congress who are the Medicare Board of Directors, but also other technical reasons. And Medicaid runs around 5-6%. That's probably a more legitimate government example. The high costs of health care, of administrative costs, are also related to managed care. We do a lot more managed care than other countries do, who just ration by underpaying people and then say try to find, at least for certain kinds of care, try to get access to them. Other kinds of care, they're better than we are, so I don't want to make a value judgment there. But the punchline is we get something for that money, extra money, and it's only about 15% of the total. That's enough to pay my salary for the rest of my life, for sure, but it's not going to make the enormous difference between, you know, 18% of GDP and 40% of GDP that we want.
Well, we have Simon Johnson. We've just got 45 seconds left here. It did go by quickly. I want to give you a chance to have a last response to Mark Pauly.
By any measure, Meghna, we have the most inefficient healthcare system in the world. Now, maybe we should be proud of it. Maybe we should celebrate that. Maybe we should push. Excuse me, Mark. Maybe we should push up.
That's not true, but.
Go ahead. This is the problem. People don't want to have a debate about the facts, Meghna. We have the most inefficient healthcare system among all the industrialized countries. That's what data show. Senator Warren will cut through that. It's an $11 trillion effective tax cut for households over the next 10 years, and everybody gets the same kind of health insurance as members of Congress get. Why is that a bad idea?
Well, Simon Johnson is a professor of entrepreneurship at the MIT Sloan School of Management, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, and he co-authored two expert letters for the Warren campaign taking a look at the cost structure of her proposal. Simon Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Mark Pauly, professor of healthcare management, business economics, and public policy at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Mark Pauly, thank you.
Sure.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.